scrap, 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 scrap.
Mike!
I'm mean, I'm fierce, I'm mad, I'm rude, I got that pro fighter attitude. I'm in the octagon with the podcast on, let's talk about it on Scraptitude. You know I've been the best, grab my belt and begin to flex so wild I might hit the ref. We got the winner circle segments and the 2-on-5 takeaways with Tim and Jeff. So just kick back, grab a brew, it's fight night, so you know what we have to do. Whether a power punch or a grapple move, you know we got you covered on Scraptitude. So just kick back, grab a brew, it's fight night, so you know what we have to do. Whether a power punch or a grapple move, you know we got you covered on Scraptitude, yeah.
Scrap, scrap, scrap,
scrap, scrap, yeah.
Hey yo everybody, what's up to episode number 60 something, I think, of the Scraptitude podcast. We are highly prepared today. I am your co-host Timothy Lewis, and joining me is a man who believes Aspen Ladd needs to take the 12 cheeseburgers out of her pocket.
Well, I'll tell you guys what happened to those cheeseburgers, but you know, OR215, Deputy Aikens, the man of the people, you know.
Brilliant. How you doing today, Jeff?
I'm doing great. It got cold as shit overnight. It was out of pocket. It's cold this morning, bro. It's very cool. But it's a nice day. The sun is shining.
It's beautiful.
And we're out here getting after it.
Yeah, baby. Well, that fall weather is kicking in, man. I don't know. I messed up my back real bad, Jeff. Do you have any recommendations? Have you ever had like sciatic pain? You know that nerve, John, that like goes down your leg and up your back?
Damn, that's ridiculous. I would say is you need to decompress. You should probably hang from your arms. Do it.
I tried a little hanging situation. And it provides like temporary relief. There's some good stretches I've gotten into, but this shit, it's by far the worst my back has ever been. I'm not a bad back person, but now I feel like I'm a bad back person. Isabella's calling me her old man. It doesn't matter. Up this chair, it ain't got enough lumbar support.
Well, you
up,
can do the upside down, John, and then I would suggest adopting a regimen of back exercises that will strengthen the muscles.
Well, I think it's like a lot of sitting during the day doing work, and then it's like intermittent
damn, bro, are you telling me you got that Luke Rockhold feminine back?
No, I ain't got a feminine back. My discs are masculine. They are thriving and full of testosterone, but but it is fucked up right now. And I'm glad I don't have some crazy Sean Strickland motherfucker talking about sexualized violence trying to hunt me down while I'm waddling around barely walking.
Yeah, I'm sure you're the definite prey he's looking at, you know, looking out for.
Yeah. Did you hear what he was saying, Sean Strickland? He was that whole post that he had about like being sexually attracted to violence or whatever. Yeah,
yes. He's not the first person to say that, but it's definitely weird.
Yeah, he's I feel like we all had one guy like that in high school, at least one, you know, somebody who's like posts like weird like gothy pictures online, and but he's an actual cage fighter. He actually does the damn thing.
Surprised he's not in jail. Especially being a cage fighter, I'm surprised he's not in jail.
But yeah, real shit. I mean, with the way he holds his chin up in the air, you gotta worry about some CTE someday. But I'll be real though, Sean Strickland, he goes in there with intent, and he's willing to risk it for the biscuit. That was gonna be the ultimate fight between two guys with their chins pointing straight up in the air though. Waiting for a highlight reel double knockout.
Oh my god, that's probably what would happen too.
But then, if any of y'all got the suggestions, I'm gonna hit my chiropractor up, see what's good with that. But if y'all got the suggestions for the sciatic pain. This, John, is horrible. It's bad. I'm not having a good time. Hit me up. Let me know the cure. Colorado is joining Kansas in believing that the cure to MMA scoring is having an open scoring system. For those that aren't aware, an open scoring system is where the judges' scorecards are revealed after each round, thereby giving fighters an account of where they stand in reference to the judges' scoring. Yeah. Do you think that open scoring, we've probably talked about before, do like the concept?
I mean, it has its uses, but it also has its limitations. And to be quite honest, I don't think we need it. I mean, I just got to be real. The only people that are really out here looking to the judge's scorecard to see if they're up are going to be your corner and the people that are trying to, you know, point fight and make the fight boring. And I don't support that.
Well, what about the fighter that there's been two competitive rounds and they find themselves down 0-2 on the majority of the judges' scorecards? In their particular case, it would incentivize them to level up their risk threshold, you know, to be more willing to take risks and go for the finish in a fight.
Like they should be doing that shit anyway.
Risk reward equation.
They should be doing that shit anyway. If you're sitting here in a battle for your life and you're not sure if you're about to win, Nick, you better kill that other dude.
But we got the whole sample size that says that guys that believe that they're up two rounds, like they don't go for it, or guys that think they're in a certain standing. I get it.
Well, then maybe they don't got that killer instinct and they don't want it.
Okay, so you think that psychologically it shouldn't matter. The fighter should always go for the kill. I agree with it in principle. I agree with it in principle.
And you can't. We can't be adopting a rule that does nothing for the safety of the competitor and nothing to incentivize the finish of the fight, in my opinion.
Well, I think it does incentivize. Well, it does and it doesn't. And that's why I think you need to experiment with it overall. Like Colorado, Kansas, I'd like somebody to be taking some data on if this policy increases or decreases finish rates. Because I think we agree that we enjoy the violence of the sport.
They should
just
pay more for finishes. Maybe they should give finish bonuses then instead. Give a financial incentive instead of some corny rule that lets people potentially.
Which UFC does to an extent with performance bonuses.
See? So, and there you go. So instead of them whining about, I don't know if I'm ahead, maybe you should think, maybe I can win $50,000 and try and finish the fight.
Gotcha. And I think that that's a fair incentivization. I would say the other side, and what it does intrigue me, is how throughout sports, you know the score, so you know what you need to do in that situation. Situational awareness is super important, and it's the same for both fighters. So you could say that both guys have the same challenge, the same opportunity. Mm. But situational awareness, the amount of information available, does change strategically how guys approach the fight. I'm not sure if it would have a negative or a positive impact. I'd be interested to see a sample size.
So here's a good question about it. So this is from the fans' perspective. Do you think that it would add a little bit more drama?
I think it does. And it adds a little more fan engagement. Fans could boo the judges and shit like that. Like it would be... You know,
so
it'd be another way to interact.
Are you going to see which judge's score is whose?
And then you could do things like you could see. Well, yeah, I mean, I don't know if they should reveal that mid fight. That could be dubious. But it'd be interesting to see like fans weigh in and maybe like a meter that shows who the fans think won the round versus how the judges scored. I don't know, man. I just think that it's an age old question. And there's always going to be complaints about judging. And there's even shifts according to athletic commissions or who's judging or slight changes to the rules that influence how judges are perceiving criteria. And as a fighter, I think I would want to know if second round of the fight, after the second round, I would want to know if I'm winning, losing, what I got to do. Because no matter what.
To know if you're winning or losing. You just finish the pool.
But if I'm going to point, but that's not, yeah, I get your incentivization structure, but it's more just would fighters want to know where they stand? And I think most fighters would want to know where they stand in respect to the scoring of a fight.
I mean, I imagine they would, and I'm sure that, I don't know, it seems like.
Take Max versus Bolt.
Uh-huh.
I could totally see that being a fight where we would have liked to have open scoring so you could see it's 2-2 going into the fifth.
But are we under the assumption that Max Holloway wasn't trying to finish the fight the whole time? Because trying to finish the fight is tricky, man,
because you're talking about trying to finish a fight, but there's also like letting the finish come to you and not like loading up too much on your power shots, fighting freely,
but there's
taking
also,
the opportunities as they come.
But there's also recognizing that you're in the last round of the fight and that if the fight's ebb and flow has not gone in your favor as much as you would like it, then you need to find that competitor in yourself to either close it out and finish it, or try and dominate the round to the point where it's not questioned. And if you don't have it in you to do that enough times, you know, you and the dude across from you know that. And I'm not really going to sit here and say that a new scoring method is going to really alter that. Because if you're in there getting your ass beat and you think you're in a super competitive fight, then you know what you need to do. You need to put the pedal to the metal and you need to try and finish it. And if you can't try and finish it, then you need to dominate. There's like that. That's not going to change.
Regardless of the psychology of the fight and the mentality a fighter should have, we do know statistically that most fights go to a decision. And that half of a fighter's purse oftentimes is in the balance of how that decision goes. And so if I'm a fighter, I want to know, even if it's just like an additional little kick in the ass to do what I already should be doing, I want to know like what my risk equation is.
And they should
in
get
that
rid of
moment.
The win. Then get rid of show and win and just give them a flat fee.
Okay, but that's not what I'm talking about. What we're talking about is the Colorado joining Kansas for open scoring and the merits of open scoring. That's kind of like saying like, oh, should poor people get better welfare, but oh, no, but what about the military?
MMA open scoring for MMA loses its merit when you compare it to the ability to incentivize fighters to finish, in my opinion.
Okay, yeah, okay. So I think that's well said, and we do want things that encourage fighters to go in there with a bloodthirsty mindset. That's what we're here for. Speaking of bloodthirsty mindset, we have Luis Peña. Apparently, he was just released from the UFC. Well, not apparently. It is. Well, it's highly apparent that he was released from the UFC for a domestic violence issue. The 911 audio was revealed to have said that his significant other called saying that she was punched in the face.
Damn.
So it's a tough one. I mean, not that all these situations aren't tough, but it's graphic. It's kind of like the Ray Rice situation where you see him knock his wife out in the elevator. It's like when you get to that level of representation of the incident, it's more visceral and it creates a more visceral reaction by the employing organization, in this case, the UFC.
But this isn't even the first time either, right?
Yeah, no, I remember something a couple months ago coming out about Luis Peña and domestic violence. He is truly the violent Bob Ross, and without making too many jokes, because domestic violence is a very serious issue. How does this reflect on some of the other cases going on in the UFC, such as Greg Hardy, where it was also a visceral case where there was bruises revealed and there was a settlement reached in court? And also that of John Jones, where his wife was said to have a bleeding lip or bloody nose, something of the variety. There's some questions in the air about exactly what went down there. Do you think that Luis Peña's release reflects how the UFC should act or perhaps what they're not doing properly in regards to Greg Hardy and John Jones?
Well, I guess it's weird because how visceral, like, you know, because Greg Hardy did it and John Jones, I don't know if there's any direct in the moment stuff happening. And I haven't really delved deep enough into John Jones' case to really know about it, but I guess the UFC is grasping at this, 9/11 audio and all this stuff, and maybe they see it as worse in some sense. Honestly, I don't really know, because it's all pretty bad.
9/11 audio.
I don't know. It's so weird because it's like it clearly shows one, a favoritism, and two, it's a confusing ass favoritism because Greg Hardy does not sell tickets. The nigga doesn't win fights, and
well,
John Jones hasn't fought in years, and it's like, what are we, like, it's odd.
I'll tell you what, with Greg Hardy, though, when he fights, you do see in the search results, things like that, he's usually one of the highest searched fighters in a given event. So, and he's definitely on social media whenever he fights for negative reasons. He's usually one of the most talked about fighters. So I do think there is a correlation between how forgiving the UFC is, what their tolerance is for domestic violence or any kind of crime, and how popular or high standing a fighter is within their organization. The John Jones thing, well, I think you compare in the Jeff's Dark Libations, you compare it to like a hostage situation, those pictures. I thought I heard something about that, where he's taking pictures with his wife. And she's very wide-eyed and, I don't know, seems very tense. Okay, how about this, Jeff? Give me some this overall John Jones situation, because we all know Greg Hardy's a despicable piece of shit, and we all root for him to get knocked out. But there's this John Jones situation now, and he's putting out all kinds of crazy tweets and Instagram posts, compensatory stuff, explanatory stuff.
John Jones' thing is very sad, because he's like real-time. He's super real-timing, and we see it a lot more than we see Pena, because like we're... Like, this whole thing with Pena is after the fact. Like super, super after the fact. Like, all this shit is, I'm assuming, a few days after. And John Jones, we kind of found out, like, the night or the morning after it happened, in some sense, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, but so, it's also his process of reacting to and processing the information is himself.
Oh, yeah. And John Jones has taken quite possibly the worst route he could take. Besides, I guess, no. The worst route he could take is getting fucked up and beating his wife literally on video for everyone all the time. That would be worse. But he's like denying it and speaking for his family instead of letting them like say how they feel. And he's just like, oh, I gotta get back in. I'm done with alcohol and all this shit. It's like, John, it's like that shit is so past. Like, I'm done with alcohol. Like, it's so past that to the point where you're like, bruh. Like, how he about should, this? Like, the Winklejohn shit and all that, like, John.
Well, here's the other thing, is John Jones, there's not really a right word to use for it. You could say rationalizing, explaining, but he said things like that he was molested as a child, and he connected this trauma to his own drinking, and why he's unable to control his behavior when he's under the influence of alcohol. That's kind of like a bombshell thing that's just getting tossed around as a detail chaos.
That's because that's sociopath shit, where you have something that that very well may be the reason you're acting out, but instead of you talking about this thing and working through it in a positive sense, you're like, you're continuing to act like shit. And then when people start to call you on it, they're like, I was molested. And it's like, I mean, that's terrible.
For being an asshole.
Yeah, it's like, being a piece of shit. But I don't need to know that to know that you're still an asshole. And two, if that's the issue, you should be working through that. And this shouldn't be happening.
It was very much like the Kevin Spacey, but I'm gay thing. Remember that? It was like when they was accused of sexually harassing or assaulting that 15-year-old or whatever it was, and he said, "Yeah," and I choose, like, he was like, "I don't remember if it happened, but I'm gay." Ta-da! And it's kind of like, "But I was molested." Ta-da! Like a get out of jail free card, and that's like, so, I see how you say that's sociopathic.
Well, it's
even
because
it could undoubtedly be a real cause of trauma and why he can't consume alcohol. You already know this happened, and that you have this trauma. Mm-hmm. That gets stirred up when you drink. So you're just like subjecting yourself to these behaviors.
Well, it's not just that they're subjecting themselves to it. It's that they know it exists. They know it's bad. And instead of them working through it in a positive sense, they're just allowing themselves to act out. And it's one thing if you're a child and you haven't had, like, you know, years of interacting with other human beings and being in society and recognizing that's not how you act. But when you're John's age, it shows that you have consistently decided to not address this certain thing. And when you have acted out, you have this in the back of your mind that you can say this to anyone and it'll solve the issue, because that motherfucker said it to every single person on Twitter clearly and didn't give a fuck. And that's not something that people would just willingly talk about a lot. So clearly he has it in his mind. It's something that represents something. And while it may represent something to us, as a trauma to be worked at and to be fixed. To him, it represents a trauma that's meant to be manipulated and used to the advantage of yourself to manipulate others. And that's like that's that powerful sociopath shit.
All right. I feel that. And well, John Jones is a lot of things, a lot of the not positive things. People say like you got to separate the character, the person from the athlete. But and that is true in terms of the spectrum of behavior, but in terms of the spectrum of who they are, like people are like part of but being a special athlete, a worldly talent with, and having the work ethic and the all the different things that it takes to get to that point, that is part of who somebody is, and it's part of what we appreciate about people. It doesn't excuse their behavior or anything like that, but it does give me a heavy heart in this situation with somebody who's so immensely talented. That's been so formative to my experience enjoying mixed martial arts is simultaneously, you know, a piece of shit.
Well, you know, it's kind of like you live your life and no one's perfect. And it's very hard to attempt to push that type of image of yourself out there. And in John's case, we've seen him in multiple different stages of his life try to portray himself as someone he isn't. And until he comes to terms with who he is, he can't really show anyone else who that person is. So we don't really know who John Jones is, to be quite honest. John Jones has put many different versions of himself in front of us. And the only version that we've seen that's any type of consistent is him kind of like in the back of a cop car or something like that.
Yeah, I'd argue that our actions generally show who we are. Like our thoughts oftentimes manifest as actions, but our actions are ultimately the legacy that we're judged upon. Now, Francis Ngannou, I wish I had a button, Jeff. I wish I had a button that started like something like fighter pay alert, fighter pay alert. Like, uh-oh, it's coming. We're about to talk about some fighter pay shit. Francis Ngannou claims he's borrowing money for his training camp to defend his title versus Francis Cyril Gane. Jeff, do you think the heavyweight champion of the world, somebody who hits like a Ford Escort and who has had the promotional headwinds or tailwinds or whatever behind him, pushing him forward, that is, as a UFC superstar, what does it say to you that Francis Ngannou is borrowing money to defend or to pay for his training camp?
Well, I mean, the first thing that I think of is, you know, is there a point where a fighter earns this, you know, the right to kind of like fight less often? And is that where we find ourselves with Francis Ngannou? And does he have a point in it? Him having to borrow money for his training camp, I think is one, a indicative of the times that money is not worth what it used to be. And in a world where the amount of money that they can make is so exponential, I'd imagine that their costs can get exponential as well. And that someone in his position may very well need more money to maintain. And this is silly, but this is the game that we're in, to maintain not just the lifestyle, but the physical things that he has to do as what is perceived the baddest man on the planet, you know, because Francis Ngannou isn't like a guy who doesn't fight like regularly. And that's in comparison to his peers. And well,
Jeff, but he has two fights in the last 2 years.
Yeah, but when I mean his peers, I'm talking about the last 4 or 5 heavyweight champions.
Okay.
DC and Stipe both fought about 4 times in 4 years at a similar clip, rematching each other. Cain Velasquez only fought 6 times in 5 years. And that's including him winning the title back and everything. And Verdum won the title and then took a year off and lost it to Stipe. So it's not like there's this crazy paradigm that Ngannou's trying to set where he wants to fight way less than any of his contemporaries. He's in fact fighting at about the same clip. So it really does beg the question, is do these fighters need to be paid more? And is what they're being paid so little that comparison to their peers who are able to hire these people at the highest level, can they just not keep up? Or is this indicative of Francis Ngannou spending way too much money and doing crazy shit? And I'm not going to lie, I haven't seen a picture of Francis Ngannou in a Ferrari or in a Lamborghini. So I'm not going to sit here and say he's blowing through a shit ton of money like that. And that's the type, you know, and that's kind of the an interesting aspect of it. You know, spending money quick is flashy. And if we're not seeing Francis balling out, he probably ain't balling out. The man might have a lot of stuff piled up, and maybe the man who's supposed to be the baddest man on the planet could stand to make more than, you know, 750K in a year. Maybe he should fight more, but maybe we should accept the fact that he is the heavyweight champion, and maybe we don't get to see him all the time. Maybe that's the allure, you know?
Well, I think a big part of it, Jeff, not to cut you off, but I think a big part of it is because so much of what he was doing over the last couple of years was contingent on this trilogy between Stipe and Daniel Cormier. So it's like he had to wait for a long time, and he was due that title shot. So it didn't make sense for him to go and keep taking a bunch of fights. And everybody was complicit with the fact that he earned that title shot. So he has expenses that are coming through, whatever. So he makes this $730,000, and then whatever else from sponsorships and so on. He makes a good chunk of change. But the way that these guys train at the top level, bringing in sparring partners, nutritionists, traveling, doing this and that.
Think about this.
You're not just flying yourself. You're paying for a team of people.
Here's a really good one to show how expensive this type of shit is. Floyd Mayweather, right, in his fight with Andre Berto. Floyd Mayweather had a cryo machine that cost somewhere north of $250,000. You know what I'm saying? Like, that's the type of shit when you need to be at the highest level. Those are the type of things that those dudes can buy. And that's the type of shit that you should be having when you're an athlete at the highest level competing. And people want to sit here and they want to talk about, oh, well, he doesn't have to do that. He can go to the performance center. It's like you don't go to the performance center. This isn't someone who's has the membership to the gym and he's just a really fit guy who passes everybody on the treadmill. That's not what we're talking about.
Yeah, we're talking about the cream of the crop here.
Pinnacle. And when you're at the pinnacle, you require the pinnacle of all the aspects of that sport. And we can't sit here and demand Francis Ngannou fight more for small amounts of money if it's not going to allow him to get access to the things that allow him to perform at the level we want. It's just, we can't have our cake and eat it too. There is a real medium, and the heavyweight champion of the world is if there's anyone who is paid in combat sports, that's the man who's paid in combat sports.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm sure there's some balance here between, okay, how you're regulating your finances versus the UFC having to pay you more. I know I defend the UFC a lot. Francis Ngannou is a fucking man. Francis Ngannou has been this guy that the UFC has been trying to get behind for years. And the UFC should want this man to be fully exploring his talent.
He should be saying, I love the UFC all the time.
But what I'm saying is a little bit of this might also be Francis Ngannou unhappy with the UFC. The UFC has bullied him around with this interim title. And now there's guys like Jake Paul and Oscar De La Hoya and a number of fighters all raising complaints about fighter pay. Once again, it's circulating the news. It always does, but the tide has come out a little bit further this time. I think Francis Ngannou is taking his opportunity to get some more jabs in at the UFC. He's unhappy with the organization. He's looking for other ways to make money. He's looking for ways to get his name in the spotlight. He's been tossed around with like boxing and so on. There's actually Todd Atkins. He was mentioning something about Francis Ngannou's contract and how Francis Ngannou is out of contract in like a year and a half or something like that, and could look to make the transition to boxing and try to get a super fight in boxing. So I think a lot of some of it might be Francis Ngannou is tight on cash. I think some of it's also that there is, you know, some politics being played here. And these politics with fighter pay bleed right into the World Fight League, who issued another statement, another very abstract statement about their intent, how they're going to be creating this league with 50-50% revenue and so on. But they had one line that was intended to catch the eye of onlookers. And that line is this: a growing number of influential entities within the sports industry are assembling to build this new and super necessary league, the statement wrote. That has to be George Masvidal. It has to be.
I don't think it's.
It's like this whole professional well-worded statement about their objectives, reasserting their goals, and so on. And then they have this one line that says "super necessary." That language, right after talking about influential entities within the sports industry, you're saying "super necessary" with the guy who hashtags all his tweets "super necessary," who just started a bare knuckle MMA league in Florida himself.
I think it's a visibility ploy more than it is a revelation as to who it is.
So you think they get a little deception?
Well, one, "super necessary" is probably a very common hashtag and used phrase online, and that guarantees it gets this thing shown more, including it in like a big phrase like that. So,
okay.
If I were to look at the WFL, my thing is they probably pitched this to a lot of people, similar to trying to own a soccer team when they were first trying to like get those leagues and shit, or have people, you know, form together and own leagues and stuff like that, you know, as a way to get in on the ground floor and have something that may grow into an absurdly valuable asset to have. And I think that they may have picked up someone, you know, I don't know. It's the Fertitta sold the UFC for like, what is it, $4 billion? Some fucking ridiculous shit like that. You know, there is money there. So
it's estimated to be worth 10.
Yeah. So you think about it, who is that incentivizing? And with all of these bold claims, that's all I can think about, is that there has to be some sort of large fund individuals behind this that have seen the Fertittas take that and are looking to do something similar.
Okay. Yeah, well, I'm making a prediction here. I think that it is directed at Jorge Masvidal. I think that he is going to have one of those teams. And I think that it helps on multiple fronts. It helps with somebody that actually knows mixed martial arts, because you're going to have owners and people involved. Maybe Masvidal will be a GM, or he'll be an owner or part owner, whatever. But it has somebody that has knowledge within the sport, how to train, how the business side works. You've also got somebody with knowledge of the promotional aspect, and somebody that's going to be a popular face among the sports audience. It's going to make things a little more compelling starting out, having Jorge Masvidal's team. I think that the super necessary, while it absolutely could be a ploy, a little bit of misdirection, Jorge Masvidal's been looking to secure that major bag to establish his brand. He has that tequila. He has the Game Bread Fight League now, the bare knuckle mixed martial arts league in Florida. I think that it's kind of the pieces coming together here. Everything's coalescing. I could totally see this being a way for him to develop talent and rapport and so on, this Game Bread Fight League, as a possible entry to the WFL.
Possibly.
We mentioned briefly about Luke Rockhold withdrawing from his 268 fight against Sean Strickland. It's a blow to the UFC 268 card. I don't know if Strickland gets a replacement. Were you looking forward to seeing Luke Rockhold, and how did you think that fight was going to play out?
Luke is always a funny fight to watch. I expected him to strangle Strickland, but
really?
Yes. Luke Rockhold has still easily one of the best top games in the UFC. The man is a monster in the ground game, especially when it comes to putting pressure on dudes similar size than him. It's something that he does. It doesn't get him punched in the face, so he can be really good at it. And it, we've seen Luke melt ridiculously accomplished MMA grapplers from the top position. So it is what it is. Strickland was probably going to be some fucking nut, angry, bold, over aggressive. God fucking knows what's wrong with him. And, you know, I saw, you know, Luke, you know, securing the takedown, getting in there, getting it done quick. But that's neither here nor there, because Luke had a feminine, has feminine arch in his back. And clearly, yeah, he's not able to make it to the fight day.
Yep. Herniated discs in his lower back. You know, I saw it going the other way. I thought Strickland was going to beat the shit out of Luke Rockhold. Rockhold's always so cocky, but then he folds under pressure. He doesn't have good takedown entries. Sean Strickland does have good takedown defense. His boxing is better than Rockhold's. He's able to excel in the pocket, and he doesn't give you an ounce of breathing room. Rockhold likes to dictate the pace and reset, and it was just going to be an uncomfortable return fight for a 36, 37-year-old Luke Rockhold. I didn't like that fight for him at all.
Oh, I thought it was definitely it was more winnable than I thought than that for Luke. And I saw there's, but it doesn't really matter now because he's feminine arch.
Feminine vertebrae.
He was arching too hard for his pics at the during his modeling gig.
Oh my god! Yeah, arching that ass out. Aspen Ladd lost her main event fight at 145 pounds to Norma Dumont. She was a minus 140 favorite. A week prior, she failed to weigh in at 135 pounds, visibly shaking on the scale. Some fighters, fans, including Misha Tate, accused her of trying to cheat the system, trying to hold onto the tarp and take a couple pounds off, not weighing in. On the digital scale in the back before coming out, playing all the sneaky tricks. And then she eats all the cheeseburgers, weighs in at 145 pounds, and takes a loss last night, getting outstruck 2-1 by Dumont. Jeffrey, tell us about these 12 cheeseburgers.
Well, I'm going to tell you what really happened, Tim. Fatty Laddie dropped her cheeseburgers all over the octagon and forgot she was in a fight.
Fatty Laddie.
And you know what? And you could tell her coaches are in there giving her all these good information and giving her the tools, all this. And all you can see is that 1,000-yard stare. She's sitting there distracted, thinking about where's my quintuple with cheese? I just had it in my back pocket. Where is it at? And you see her. She's just looking around the octagon instead of throwing punches and trying to actually win the fight. You know, and maybe she found one in the, she might have found one, you know, in the third or fourth round, and she was able to eat and get some energy, but clearly,
she
just did not know what to do.
Yeah, well, did you hear at all what her corner man, who's also her boyfriend or husband or something, said? He's like, yo, why ain't you fighting? Throw punches.
Because she's just looking for cheeseburgers, bro. I don't know.
She was looking for cheeseburgers. But she did have a lack of volume that, you know, normally she fights with a little more pressure, a little more volume in her style. You look at her significant strikes landed.
Because she's fucking overweight and has not been doing the due diligence for her conditioning. And she's crumbling from it.
Well, she is coming back from an ACL tear. That is something to keep in mind when talking about, like, her ability to maybe do the cardio and get down to 135 pounds.
You know, you gotta recognize and make that decision, I guess. But at the same time, she clearly wasn't able to make weight in the first fight. The UFC, for some stupid fucking reason, decides to book her in a main event. Did we expect her, after struggling to make weight and then bloating up to 145 pounds, that she was gonna be what, ready? Like, come on, dude. Like, come on. Like, it's stupid to the point where, why did anyone expect anything other than a shit showing from her? Like, I don't know.
She was a minus 140 favorite.
That's because people are fucking dumb. Like I said, everyone is not looking at what is actually happening here. This girl is not doing what she needs to do with her nutrition, and it is fucking up and fucking with what she has to do. If she wants to come back from an injury and it's harder, she needs to be more restrictive and recognize she needs more discipline. It is what it is. You want to be an athlete at this level, accept the responsibility, do the job. You're supposed to be a professional.
Well, there were also questions surrounding Ladd if she was something of a weight bully, if she really had the acumen, the skill profile, or if she was leveraging her superior strength, her superior fight night weight in top position, and that her skills were accentuated by a size advantage. Do you think that maybe this has something to do with the, you know, the leniency of weight cutting overall, the lack of regulation for how big a fighter can be the week before, or, you know, like it seems as though weight bullying is a really, is a truly relevant aspect of mixed martial arts. And she looked super, super average against somebody that's not heralded in Norma Dumont. Aspen Ladd looked like a very average fighter, and she was supposed to be a contender in the division below.
It's because we are – all right, so first, yes, there is a little bit of that aspect into it. The weight-cutting issue is a thing. But one of the reasons we have to – you don't look at Aspen Ladd in that fight last night and think, oh, this is a fighter who is healthy and knows what they need to be doing. It wasn't just a lack of skill. It was – It was a combination of a bad weight cut that she just went through, and I'm sure probably bloating up before she decided to make the quick turnaround or whatever to go back into this main event. And it shows that, one, the UFC is ready to throw any hot body that they can get into place just to fucking get a fight out. But two, it's indicative of that she needs to get, and this is specific to Aspen Ladd, she needs to fix that shit. And that's what that is. Because
look at Mackenzie Dern.
Yes.
She was missing weight.
Mackenzie Dern, yeah, she did get it together, right?
Everybody's like, her cake's too crazy. She can't weigh in. She doesn't have the cardio. And there's still questions about her cardio, but she revamped her strength and conditioning program and reshaped her body in a way that allowed her to make that weight cut easier and be stronger on fight night. Aspen Ladd's.
Too many excuses out here, bro.
She's big and she's strong, but she's not so astronomically large for the division like that. It should be so much more significant of a problem for her getting her weight down compared to everyone else.
I don't got time for these excuses, man. I just don't. Aspen Ladd needs to stop with the cheeseburgers and start accepting the fact that if she wants to be a professional fighter, she needs to act like a professional.
Indeed. Now, a professional fighter who's not acting like a professional is Conor McGregor, who is 10 weeks out from healing his leg and punching celebrities left and right. First, he aims a shot at Machine Gun Kelly, and now he reportedly punches famous Italian DJ Francesco Facinetti, breaking his nose. Now, this has apparently multiple witnesses. It was written about by Facinetti's wife. She claims that McGregor is dangerous and that people need to be wary of him. The story goes that Facinetti and McGregor have been partying for 2 hours before McGregor invited him to another party. They were talking, having a good time, and then for absolutely no reason, which is the story as it goes at this time, McGregor unleashes a short punch and breaks the nose of the Italian DJ. Jeff, have you read about this story? Yes. Seems like it's probably true.
Oh yeah, it's classic. It seems like a classic Conor McGregor story.
I mean, like, he's in Italy at like a club.
He's at an event where people are sucking his dick. Someone decides to maybe not suck his dick. He's on cocaine. Punches him.
It seems like cocaine might be a problem for Conor. Is that a common sentiment?
I mean, cocaine's a problem for anybody who has enough money and enough of it.
Yeah. Well, it's just wild how things, it's like this is how it must have been with like Tyson, I guess, or like some other guy, like, you know, these larger than life figures who are just,
yeah,
like,
but no one ever gave
free falling in front of his nose.
I know. But then he punched someone in the face.
But what I mean is just like to have this larger than life athlete figure just nosediving in front of you. It seems surreal. It seems like almost like Like you, you give them like too much credence or control of their own situation and circumstances because they're a dedicated athlete, because they're in shape and famous, and you see their face every day. But it seems like this is a classic nosedive.
I don't know. It doesn't seem as much as a nosedive. It's more of Connor just being himself. And he's always, I mean, he's been like caught cheating on his wife. He's been getting all fucked up. I mean, the dude's. Yeah,
that was a nosedive too. That was like, that
I know,
was like precipitous fall just, that. And yeah, he hasn't been the same type of fighter since. But maybe it's not rock bottom. Certainly.
No, John Jones is rock bottom. Conor McGregor is, because of how much more money Conor has than John, Conor McGregor's rock bottom is a little bit further.
Well, can you be rich and rock bottom?
Until his wife leaves and takes half his money and he loses his kids now.
Okay, that would be rock bottom.
Yes, and then he gets knocked out and then they leave and he loses all his money. And then
you ever see that picture of that old guy's mugshot who was like claiming to be Conor McGregor?
Yeah, right.
I feel like that's like a time traveling McGregor of what rock bottom looks like, and he was trying to come back and warn him to stop cocaine, but got too fucked up in the process.
Oh fuck, poor guy. That's funny shit, actually. Jesus Christ. No.
Well, that concludes the news segment. We wanted to introduce a new segment of the podcast. For those who tuned into our last episode, or what was supposed to be our last episode, that was instead the immaculate inaugural episode of Jeff's Dark Libations. We're trying to incorporate a segment into that, but for such a deliberation that requires really insightful inspiration, and I guess we didn't have that this week, Jeff.
There are certain things that have to come to fruition in a specific sense, and they were not necessarily there yet.
Okay. And we'll have to make sure you have plenty of libations come these next couple of weeks, such that perhaps we can deliver a segment for the people next time.
We have plenty of libations, but we need more. I need something new from the universe here. The MMA fighters have been shuffling in the domestic violence cauldron for a little long. That pot might be overcooked.
My
libations are always fresh and delicious.
Fresh and delicious. Now, before we get out of here with our 215 takeaways, there's one fight that it's just such a good fight. And I did the numbers ahead of Tim Talk. I started on the 267 Tim Talk numbers. Just got the main and co-main event done so far. And I'm looking at these stats for Piotr Jan and Corey Sandhagen. And these dudes, they've got the same number of fights. They're very similar in terms of strength and schedule and performance. Piotr Jan just edges him out ever so slightly. But he has this unique challenge in Corey Sandhagen, who's the tallest guy in the division at 5'11", a really unique style that's hard to train for. This fight is so intriguing, Jeff. You just know you're getting one of the most skillful displays of mixed martial arts in this one. And it should be like a fan-friendly fight, like two guys that are in there for the kill. What are your early inclinations about Corey Sandhagen versus Piotr Jan?
My early inclination is Piotr Jan to win. But his diversity that I've seen, I think we have seen him in there with a not stronger sense of schedule, as he hasn't really fought any contenders besides Jose Aldo. But
Aljamain Sterling,
he lost that fight, so it doesn't really mean anything.
Oh, Corey Sandhagen, you're saying? No.
I'm talking about Piotr Jan.
Yeah, he lost that fight, but he kicked his ass.
It doesn't matter. He took an L.
He did take an L.
So one of the things that makes this fight more intriguing was seeing Corey Sandhagen hang in there and arguably put in the work on TJ Dillashaw, who is someone who puts on a heavy pace like Piotr Jan is going to be relying on. And one of the things about TJ that he does better than anyone is he mixes stuff very well. And one of the things that he has that Piotr Jan does not is he has a veteran's experience in high-level fights against legitimate competition, not one win against Jose Aldo and a good showing and a DQ loss. So this is where it gets interesting. And it seems that Corey Sandhagen, for the experience he brings to the table and the fights that he has had, is seems as a unknown commodity at this level almost. We think of Piotr Jan as being so crazy good, but it's Corey Sandhagen is very good, very legit, and seems to have been went from like dark horse to, you know, perennial, not favorite, but perennial underdog, I guess, you know, live dog in a sense. And it's interesting. That, at least that's the way I've seen Corey Sandhagen, you know, formulate in front of me.
Well, he's tested this unique style of his against guys that are good. I mean, he fell flat against Aljamain Sterling, but considering TJ Dillashaw came back and he looked like TJ Dillashaw for the most part, and Corey Sandhagen did his thing, in my opinion, he won that fight. This is going to be a high-level bout, and it's two guys that want to strike but have skills everywhere. Like in that Sandhagen versus Dillashaw fight, you saw them mix it up on the ground briefly. Sandhagen tore up Dillashaw's knee with a heel hook. He's a nasty dude. Like, he doesn't even care if you're going to tap. He's just going to try to rip something the fuck apart. Piotr Jan has, in the brief times we've seen him on the ground, he's unleashed some devastating ground and pound. He seemed very positionally aware and explosive against Aljamain Sterling. That's an interesting X factor to this bout is, does the fight go to the ground? Who initiates the fight going there? Like, who tries to make the fight more multidimensional because they're uncomfortable or they're being outcompeted in the striking facet? That's something that I'm curious to see. And it's not like I get that we can do X's and O's and we can pick out little things that the two of them do or could do. Like, I'd like to see body work from Piotr Jan against Corey Sandhagen. Feel like you need that. But Corey Sandhagen, man, he's got the style where he can hit and not get hit. He's able to use the full size of the octagon. And against TJ Dillashaw, he was swinging and missing bad. We've seen Piotr Jan against like Jimmy Rivera swing and miss wildly, but also set up the right shots. It's a really, really tasty fight. Like, that's the only way I could describe it. It's like, it makes me salivate just thinking about like the action that we're going to get, some of the gifs that we're going to get from that fight. They're going to be all timers.
These are facts.
So the 215 takeaways, Jeff, talk to the people about 215 Creamery.
I mean, what else is there to say? It's the best there is, the best you're ever going to get. I mean, it might get to the point where I just sound redundant, but you got to go get yourself a pint. You got to do it for pickup. You got to hit 215creamery.com. It's the only thing that matters for you and your family. Don't even worry about eating dinner tonight because it's not as good. Hit the website, get the pint, pick it up.
Family. I try to do a Vin Diesel impression, but I don't sound like Vin Diesel. Family.
And then I'll make a car sound.
Yeah. 215 takeaways brought to you by 215 Creamery. Go to the website, order yourself a pint for pickup. We're now doing 215 takeaways at the very end, giving a bold, our boldest, extra bold, super next level, extra bold 215 takeaway.
Extra bold.
Jeff.
Extra.
Give us an extra bold 215 takeaway to get us out of here.
With the right owners of these teams, the WFL is and could easily be able to usurp the UFC in the MMA market.
Damn, that's crazy. I was actually thinking of a 215 takeaway that said, it's going to fail in 2 years. It's impossible.
So,
and I was going to shit all over it, just saying how it's a gimmick ploy for the news bites and to mess with the UFC's promotional value.
So if I mean, in terms of people seeing a way to get a return on their investment, this could be a chance that a lot of investors may not get again in their lifetimes when you see it, think about it.
Mm-hmm.
It's the ability to invest in something at the ground floor and bring it up and be in total control. With a pipeline for young talent capital for healthcare for athletes and the ability to have favorable contracts, as well as potentially facilities in countries that need housing assistance. This is well poised to be just another way to funnel athletic people out of these countries that need assistance into a system that will enrich them and allow them to make a lot of money through endorsements and allow people to access these the fans of these countries in a way very similar to sport like soccer. Mm. And this is not something that can be overlooked. It is something that has worked with other sports. And
while is all the good African players are going to all of a sudden be on France's and England's team.
Well, not. I'm saying they'll be on.
Like soccer.
No, there'll be a rich African person who owns the African team, who goes and knows where these people are and has a direct pipeline to young talent there. Because they're there, it's a way for them to establish something. And with all of them together, with backing, not just for themselves, and if they do have actual high net worth individuals, the UFC, while its valuation is high, doesn't operate with impunity when it comes to money. They are at the mercy of Disney, and they have to, you know, get their checks signed and make sure that they're doing what they need to do to fit into things.
To an extent, Disney doesn't own them, but
there's a reason why there's a reason why where these cage fighters get their curse words bleeped out, and it's not because Dana White's telling them to do it.
Yeah, no, I hear you.
You know what I mean? I think that there is something real here, and if they have legitimate people in them that have the money to do it, it's a game plan. It is a game plan.
Absolutely. No, there's like a space race to Africa right now where these organizations, like the UFC is talking about building one or more performance institutes in one or more African countries. Mm-hmm. They're talking about an African division now in the WFL. I know one had I'm blanking on his name, but he was like that Senegalese wrestler, the massive dude.
Yeah.
He was and of course the UFC has three African champions right now, despite having a demographically small percentage of African fighters in the organization. So there's definitely a weapons race almost because one of the things we always talk about, man,
is accessibility. Accessibility, it's a numbers game. You know, there's tons of people out there, and when you up the reward and you increase the accessibility, You're gonna start to see more and more athletes show up, and this is a interesting idea, and I'm not gonna stomp it out because the UFC is they're not trying to copy the UFC, and that's kind of what I think is the biggest thing, because you got your Bellator, you got your Strikeforce, they're one FC, they're just trying to be UFC light, you know, and this is trying to be a league that's more akin to the NBA and stuff like that. And that is something that is a lot of money. And if you have the ability to see that far ahead and you have the funds to do it, why not? You know, that would be fucking crazy.
Yeah, it could really be something. I'm fascinated by the concept. The thing to me is it's like, okay, you've made another press release a month later saying all the same shit, except you had the word super necessary in there.
I think that's an SEO thing.
For something that's going to be out in 2 years.
I think that's SEO, 100%.
Okay, yeah, it certainly could be. Now, the thing is, they're talking about in 2 years having their North American and I think European divisions. That's going to take a lot of mobilization. A lot of stuff's going to happen fairly quickly in terms of their sanctioning, in terms of their licensing, their roster accumulation.
Well, let's not get to it.
A lot of things need to happen, so it's a huge undertaking. But I'm very intrigued as well to see how that unfolds, because I think at the very least it pushes the UFC to tilt the balance, and it seems like it's capitalism at work, could potentially fill the void.
Think about this. Remember when the PFL said it was giving $1 million to everyone that won one of their tournaments?
Yeah, and they got a bunch
of publicity. We thought that shit was fucking crazy, but they do it, and they're doing it. It's crazy. But there are people here that see this shit, and they're making money off it, and they're getting in it. So if it starts attracting bigger fish, We'll see, man. They move a lot of water.
And I love the divisions concept. I just think it creates taps into so much of the potential with, affiliating with your country and how important that is for so many mixed martial artists in the United States. It almost takes a back seat in terms of what you're representing on fight night for a lot of fighters anyways. But I think tapping into that, the nationalistic aspect of martial arts and sporting is such, taps into the heart and soul of what this is all about, which is, yes, combat, but also in a way bringing people together.
Exactly.
Now for my 215 takeaway, brought to you by 215 Creamery, there's a picture released that recently had Zhang Weili, Henry Cejudo, and Davison Figueiredo. And I'm saying all three members of the Fun Size Bandits will lose their next fight. Zhang Weili is going to get knocked out again by Rose Namajunas. Figueiredo will not make it the distance with the savage Brandon Moreno. And Henry Cejudo, whoever he comes back against, he's going to do it at 35 years old, and it's going to be to a harsh reality that these divisions have moved past him and that his accomplishments have aged poorly. I love Cejudo. He's a special athlete. But I think guys like Corey Sandhagen, guys like Petr Yan, guys like Jose Aldo, and guys like Volkanovski or Max Holloway are all, they all could give Cejudo a really rough reintroduction to the sport. Long hiatuses for fighters passing through the age apex is not recommended. And that's where Henry Cejudo finds himself right now. All three members of the Fun Size Bandit, they're the fraud dream team, and they're all going to get snuffed.
I think there's a small chance Henry Cejudo could come back and fight TJ Dillashaw. So I don't know if I agree with all of them. But okay. Yes.
And he gets promised a title shot for that fight.
I think that might happen, and it could easily happen.
I'm with that. I'm so TJ with that.
Would want that back. But
yeah, absolutely. Biggie
and Rose are definitely losing their next fights. I agree with that.
All right. So the Fun Size Bandits getting snuffed.
And it's Halloween. They're getting handed out and eaten.
Okay.
Nobody likes Fun Size anyway. Bring back the King Size candy bars.
Do you think we can call this episode Fatty Laddie, or is that too, like, body shaming? If I have to ask, it probably is, but I laughed so hard.
You could say Lad lost her burgers. You could definitely call it Lad lost her burgers, but that's just rude.
Burger Lad?
Burger Lad strikes again.
Fatty
Laddie is my pick.
Fatty Laddie. I think we're gonna do it. Like this
Fatty Laddie returns.
This has never been a role model podcast.
Fatty Laddie returns.
Fatty Laddie returns. You got it, Jeffrey.
Beautiful.
Okay, everybody. Well, we thank you very much for tuning into another episode of the Scrap Tube Podcast, an episode that will be named Fatty Laddie. My name is Timothy Lewis. This is the Scrap Tube program. Please subscribe, rate, and review. Word of mouth marketing, it's the most important. People trust people who tell them what to get sometimes. And so, you roll the dice, you tell them about us. Doesn't matter if they like stuff, they don't like stuff. Maybe they'll like our stuff. So for the most ambiguous and specific, whatever this is of all time, Scrap to always. Jeff, tell them whatever else does to say about stuff.
Hit the Twitter sphere. Find me, OR215. Jeffrey Reagan is the man of the people. Make sure, follow Timothy E. Lewis. He's the man, too. We always turn it up. Scratitude is, as always, the greatest thing you'll ever hear. And if you disagree, you're just fucking stupid. So enjoy yourselves. Enjoy this beautiful weather. Enjoy this fall season. And we will see y'all soon.
Much love, everybody. Peace.